a podcast about Canadian cinema and our relationship with film. My name is Andrew Hunter Scully, and today we are discussing Neighbours, released in 1952, directed by Norman McLaren, and written by Norman McLaren. And to join me on this deep dive into a very interesting person in Canadian film history, we have James Thornton returning. James, how are you doing, sir?
I'm good. How are you?
Not too bad. This has been a fun one. I said to you before recording, I have more notes on this episode than any other film that we've ever done. So this should be interesting.
Yeah.
So we've been going back and forth with ideas with this sort of, with these episodes on Canadian animation. Last time, obviously, you picked Beast Wars.
Yep.
So the ball came back into my court, and I wanted to kick a bucket that's been on my list for a long time, and that's to talk about Norman McLaren. We talked about Norman McLaren very briefly in our episode of 32 short films about Glenn Gould, because Norman McLaren animates a couple of the sequences there.
Yeah.
In that film. But that was just scratching the surface. Like, the surface of the surface, the veneer on the surface of what is Norman McLaren was what we scratched there. And yeah, I'm just going to get this out of the way. I made tons of notes. We're going to be talking about the NFB really in any sort of depth for the first time ever here. I think this will be episode 89 when it comes out. So this has been percolating for a long time. So I'm just going to get out of the way. You could do an entire podcast series about the history of the National Film Board.
Yeah, you could. Yeah.
Obviously, I'll hit some bullet points about the history of the NFB, because I think it's important if anybody's not Canadian to let them know what the National Film Board is. And even nowadays, even if you are Canadian, you might have even a cursory idea of what the National Film Board is. And then obviously Norman McLaren, this is not hyperbolic, is possibly the most influential Canadian filmmaker ever.
Yeah.
In the history of Canada.
Yeah.
Even though most people wouldn't know his name, like the average person. I think if you went to school for animation, if your interest in animation goes beyond the more pop culture end of things, you might know who Norman McLaren is. But we'll get to this. His legacy is far reaching than not even Canadian filmmakers. It's a longer reach than even most other filmmakers, American, world cinema, otherwise. So let's do this. James, so, okay, let's start with the NFB. What's your relationship with the National Film Board? You're a little bit younger than me.
Yeah.
I mean, for me, the National Film Board was always just kind of around. I remember when shorts and National Film Board, like, films would be shown on television.
Yeah.
You know, they'd be shown in the classroom for educational purposes, but also you'd just be watching TV. I brought up all the time things like The Log Driver's Waltz and The Cat Came Back would just be on between TV episodes. Especially when I was growing up, TV Ontario would show a lot of National Film Board stuff. What about you? What's your relationship being a little bit younger with the National Film Board?
Completely opposite.
Yeah.
Trust me. Of course, it depends on like school systems and all that jazz.
Yeah.
But for my school experience, there and watching these shorts, we watched like two of our shorts as well for this episode. It made me feel this nostalgia that isn't there, but also it's kind of like, wow, I wish my classes in elementary school showed at least like, I don't know, like Blinkety Blank or whatever. At least that, like, that's like, maybe not Neighbours, maybe not, you know, some other ones, but at least that one made sense.
Yeah.
So I was just sitting there being like, wow, like, why was this not being used? Like to my education's like, I don't know, discretion. Cause like it's the National Film Board of Canada.
Yeah.
But it's like, no, we just, a lot of Fantasia, surprisingly, for like music stuff. They would show like, just like clips from the first Fantasia film. And maybe because Fantasia 2000 came out when I was like just starting elementary school.
And maybe a teacher just had it on DVD.
They did, yeah.
And but just brought it in.
And of course, I did do French immersion in school. So at least for elementary school. So that could be another thing. But I'm just sitting there like, wow, like this was just such a void that could have been filled in my public education days. Like just a teacher putting in this NFB short on or this NFB film on. Yeah. Obviously, it's not something like Ratopolis, because we know.
No, but we'll touch upon this.
Not that. The
National Film Board puts out a wide variety of products.
But a lot of my stuff for watching NFB, like maybe let's say after age 11, 12, yeah, was watching them on YouTube, not realizing A, they were Canadian, A, it's from the NFB.
Interesting. So that much off your radar.
Yeah. Of course, eventually, you know, when I got out of my film phase, that was just, you know, I don't want to say Hollywood cinema, but like eventually being like, you know, there's other countries in the world and yeah, stuff. So then I was like, oh, hey, I remember watching this.
And surprisingly to a lot of Canadians, yeah, are like, oh yeah, our country exists yeah, too. And that's, you can actually watch.
And that's like the difference between you and I. Maybe, again, it could just be an Ontario versus Nova Scotia thing where...
I was curious. I think the National Film Board, which is why I said yeah, we should go into the National Film Board yeah, a bit, because it is so instrumental to Norman McLaren. You cannot talk about Norman yeah, McLaren without talking about the National Film Board.
Yeah.
That's one of the reasons why I want to tackle it, is mm-hmm, that I think some people, like some of our younger listeners, even if they are Canadian, yeah, might, again, only a cursory view of it, because it's not... We'll go into it. Like, mm-hmm, the National Film Board played a very important role, not just in the history of Canadian film, but also, like, Canada as a country.
Well, the funny thing, I did a few film courses at Dow for university. And I'm talking about, like, general film courses. Like, I took a class on David Lynch, and I took a class on like directors, like Kieran and like Naruto. But like the general like film courses, no mention of NFB at all. Not even like a passing like glance. Like, oh yeah, Canada has this.
Well, the mission statement of this show, and I've said this story a few times, when Skylar approached me to do a film podcast, and I didn't want to just repeat, mm-hmm, you know, white dudes talking about The Godfather and Jaws, yeah, I thought Canadian cinema might be a good one because... You know, even if we're not the biggest show on the face of the planet in terms of listenership, it is a resource out there. And yeah, it is bringing a different point of view and a different conversation,
mm-hmm,
to the film webosphere, podcast sphere,
yeah,
of these stories and these institutions and these filmmakers that are great and important. And mm-hmm, just because of our... Really, you cannot talk about even the state of film in the country now and the history of Canadian film without talking about the National Film Board, yeah, because no, of how it influenced how films were made in Canada.
Yeah, basically.
We're going to get to all of
yeah,
that.
Well, yeah, it's funny because grade 9, this would have been 2010 in the winter term of, you know, junior high. And my social studies teacher, Miss Faye, was like, let's talk about Canadian stuff. And like, I could just imagine if like they knew about the NFB and just like showed some shorts from them. Like, that would have been so interesting, because other than that, it was just like, what's Canadian? Mike Myers. Joel Plaska, because Joel Plaska is, you know, super big in the Maritimes.
Yeah, yeah.
But
you're right, quite often they bring up actors yeah, that even just work in the States.
It was basically just me being like, oh, John Candy, Rick Moranis,
yeah,
Lorne Michaels, and like all Jim Carrey. Everyone mentioned Jim Carrey. So yeah, my NFB experience was me just discovering it at a later age than being younger, which I kind of wish I did find out more about it being younger. But again, it's just different. Like, maybe if I was in Ontario, there'd be like airing shorts, like during a little like downtime.
Who knows? Because as we said, I mean, the National Film Board is still in operation. Yeah. It still produces documentaries and yeah, animated films. We will note this to the audience. Most of their films are available on YouTube.
Yeah.
If you are Canadian, you have free access to the National Film Board website and mm-hmm, app. And, you know, you can get it on your smart TV. Probably these are all accessible.
If you live in the States, everyone, you could probably just use like an IPN address change.
Well, I think on YouTube, they'd be able to access
it. Oh, yeah, 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 yeah. YouTube, yeah, yeah. Like,
so, okay, the NFB, trust me, we're going to talk more about the NFB. Mm-hmm. Hey, maybe you'll learn something today.
Yeah.
Now, Norman McLaren. Was Norman McLaren ever on your radar as an animation fan?
It took a while to get there.
But before this episode, you knew who Norman
McLaren was? Oh, yeah, I knew who he was.
Just
yeah,
making sure, man. Yeah. Just making sure.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I watched... When did I watch Chair? Was there a film class I watched? I can't remember now. That's just me going through my mind being like,
yeah,
there was some like NFB stuff I did see, but it's just like hard to think. But yeah, I knew of Norman McLaren before yeah, this. Yeah.
Okay. So before we get into anything, because this was such a research heavy episode, I do want to cite a few sources just to be completely transparent. Again, I'm also citing these sources because we're only going to be able to scratch the surface when it comes to the NFB and Norman McLaren, really. So if people yeah, yeah, want to know more about these subjects, definitely reach out to these books because they were all invaluable. Obviously, I did use some web sources. Obviously, the National Film Board website
has
a lot of great information. But in terms of print, the books that I use the most were 100 Years of Canadian Cinema by George Melnick. This has been a really great resource for all sorts of Canadian cinema while I've been doing the show. We've brought this one up before, Cartoon Capers, The Adventures of Canadian Animators by a Karen Mazakurich. Obviously doing a Canadian animation episodes on this podcast. This book is great. This was, I think, printed in 1999. I mean, it's long been out of print, but I think you can still get copies pretty cheap online for that one. Mine, you can see, had a little bargain sticker on it at one point. This one I was very happy to use. I have here, it's a hardcover brick of a book, In the National Interest, A Chronicle of the National Film Board of Canada from 1949 to 1989. I was very happy because when I decided to start growing my Canadian film book library, this is one of the first books I ever got. I just found a cheap copy online. I lucked out because I'm not quite sure how common this book is, but I found a really inexpensive copy. You can see it was an old library book from Trinity College in Toronto, which I think is kind of neat. But this is my first time I've been able to use it.
Nice.
When we did like Ratopolis and other National Film Board stuff, it just didn't come up in here.
Yeah.
So I'm very glad to finally use this. And then support your local library. I was super lucky to get a hold of this. Some years ago, the National Film Board remastered and issued a 7-disc set of Norman McLaren's work.
Nice.
You can see it's like almost like falling apart.
I know. I was like, I thought it was a book for a second.
You
like,
can see it's well. I almost missed it on the shelf with the holds in the library, right? Because I was expecting bigger. But it's amazing that the library had this and I could just sign this out for free. So again, I have no clue if this is still available or how much it would cost, but I'm thankful that the Halifax Library System dropped the money and this was available to me. Obviously, I did not watch everything, but that says a lot about McLaren's output that he made short films and it still is like 7 DVDs. That's a lot of work. So anyways, I wanted to cite those, especially when I use something new or I rely on something a lot, I like to try to remember to cite sources. So there you go. Shall we go into a brief history of the National Film Board?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay. The NFB or the National Film Board. Now the National Film Board is mainly known for two things. They don't just do these things, but what they're mainly known for are documentaries and animation. Documentaries and animations is arguably what Canada is best known for in terms of its cinema, and probably Canada's biggest legacy in its influence on cinema. And the National Film Board is the main reason for that. Now, the National Film Board is officially a federal agency of the government of Canada. So, a total government... like, it's not even funded by the government. It is part of the government. Yeah. It is an official agency. And is currently headquartered in Montreal, Quebec. Although that has moved around a bit, mainly between Ottawa and Montreal, but it is currently in Montreal. There are offices in other parts of the country. Like, there is a National Film Board office here in Halifax, which I should look into visiting. I know they do. Most of these places do have open days where you can go in. Maybe we should look into that.
Where is it in Halifax?
I'll have to look at it. I know I walked by it once.
Yeah.
Because I walked by it. Is it still there? Is it still... we'll look into that. I'm surprised I didn't think of doing that before this, but we'll look into that. Now, the National Film Board was founded in 1939 in Ottawa, Ontario. However, it is not the first such agency like that to exist in Canada. Previously, in 1918... the Government Motion Picture Bureau was founded. It is surprisingly, and in kind of a neat way, the first government-funded film production organization in the world. Was a Canadian one, which, hey, I think that's kind of cool. Yay for the Canadian government in 1918. So basically, the Motion Picture Bureau, their main purpose was to make films to promote trade and commerce. Although I do also remember looking up somewhere, it was also for immigration. To advertise Canada, not even from other countries, but within Canada to be like beautiful Saskatchewan and try to encourage people to kind of move more westward past Toronto and sort of the eastern sort of block between Montreal and Ontario that we have here, population in Canada. So that was successful for a while, but funding started to dry up during the Great Depression, which makes sense. Meaning a lack of money for new equipment. This is incredibly important because the Great Depression was during the 1930s. And that's when sound came along. So they could not afford sound equipment. So essentially what that meant is that they lost their theatrical distribution. Now, I think we should briefly just kind of go into what theatrical distribution was like at the time.
Yeah.
And that is the old classic. Not only would you have a feature film, but you would also have new reels, cartoons, things yep. like that beforehand. So that's what the Motion Picture Bureau really relied on for income to kind of sustain itself.
Mm-hmm.
And that continued to the National Film Board for many, many years, yeah. did the same same purpose, essentially, and got a lot of funding from, again, cartoons, documentaries, newsreels before touring bigger features. Now, here we get into, we say Norman McLaren is possibly Canada's most influential filmmaker. On the opposite side of that coin, we have John Grierson. John Grierson, in multiple ways, is probably the most influential person to affect Canadian cinema and its history. Again, we're doing an episode on the, ostensibly the NFB and Norman McLaren. We don't have time to do a deep dive on John Grierson. We'll hit the bullet points. Maybe at some point we'll talk to him about it more, especially if we go into any NFB documentaries precisely.
Yeah, yeah.
But we cannot talk about the NFB without John Grierson, and we cannot talk about Norman McLaren without talking about John Grierson as well, and mm-hmm. you need some context for that.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
So John Grierson, a very proud Scottish gentleman, basically described as being no-nonsense and very hard-headed.
Yeah.
He was not somebody that you wanted to get into an argument with and for him to disagree with you. he had founded the GPO film unit in the UK, which is kind of like the same service as the Motion Picture Bureau.
Yeah.
And that was a great success. Grierson himself was a documentarian and pioneering the form, to the point that it is generally agreed upon that he coined the term documentary.
Okay, cool.
So
yeah.
we have the term documentary because of Grierson.
Oh, look at that.
He was very passionate about the form of the documentary yeah, yeah. and its ability not just to tell stories, but also to provide a sort of public service.
Yeah, yeah.
And to communicate information to people. So mm-hmm. he was ideal to be working as a filmmaker within a government system.
Nice.
And like I said, we'll go into his background more specifically if and when we talk about NFB documentaries. But essentially, Grierson was brought in to reorganize a revitalize the Bureau, and in doing so, the National Film Board of Canada was born.
Yeah.
So that's where that came from. Under Grierson, the mission of the NFB was not just for filmmaking and distribution, but also, importantly, to train Canadian talent
mm-hmm.
to be filmmakers. The other purpose was to make Canadians feel more connected. So basically, to kind of spread the Canadian message. He was very much big into the idea of Canada.
Yeah.
And what is that Canadian identity? And what is that Canadian identity going to be? And basically, the National Film Board could kind of decide what that was.
Mm-hmm.
And he was never abusive of that power. But again, it was kind of neat that they would make films so somebody in Toronto could see a film about life in the prairies.
Yeah.
Or out in British Columbia or Quebec, or importantly, the Indigenous population.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether those films were successful or not, and what and who they portrayed could yeah. be argued. But that was the idea for to kind of bring sense of more national identity and education about these other parts of the country. Because as we all know, as Canadians and elsewhere, we are a huge country and very sparsely populated.
Yes.
So you could only imagine in the 1930s when the National Film Board was formed,
mm-hmm.
televisions were not in homes.
Mm-hmm.
Not every town had a movie theater.
No, no.
So these films are really important for fostering that. And one thing I didn't really know, one thing that the National Film Board did, because like, as I said, some towns didn't even have movie theaters, let alone TVs. They would actually have these people drive around in vehicles and they would set up in places.
Okay.
Cool. Like rural places where they would charge like 5 cents a person. They would set up in like an auditorium somewhere.
Yeah, yeah.
Or a, you know, like in a church or a school gym, something like that.
Yeah.
They would put up a screen and they would just show a bunch of National Film Board shorts.
Cool.
So for 5 cents, you could have this touring thing going around.
Yeah.
And you would see cartoons. You would see newsreels.
Mm-hmm.
You could, again, see documentaries about other part of the country. So this is what I mean about how important the National Film Board is to Canada.
Yeah.
Because a lot of Canadians' education during the 30s and the 40s, and at some point, not this episode, we will talk about how important the National Film Board was during World War II.
Yeah.
And the overseas war units that were sent over. There are crazy tales mm-hmm. about some of those that I've read about. But you could only think if you grew up, let's say, in Northern Ontario.
Yeah.
Or extremely rural Quebec. Quite possibly, the first moving pictures, mm-hmm. like the movies that you saw, were National Film Board shorts.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I think is really cool, right? Mm-hmm. And again, that whole idea of just touring the films around that way, I just think is a really neat idea.
No,
you could almost do a really cool, like, like fictional movie about that.
You could, yeah.
You know, yeah. About the adventures of these people sewing National Film Board shorts all over the place. Yeah, so it's important here to note, Grierson being a very no-nonsense guy basically described public service as a virtue.
Yeah.
So this endeavor of the National Film Board was something that he took very seriously. Mm-hmm. Now, this is where Grierson becomes kind of a polarizing figure. Because when I said that he is possibly the most important person in the history of Canadian cinema, is one little detail. Grierson steadfastly opposed feature film production in Canada. Like narrative films.
Yeah, yeah.
Believing Canada did not have a large enough market to support an independent feature film industry, Grierson thought that Canada was better off supporting American films production in Canada, stating, film is an international business.
You made the tax credit shelter.
Well, you know, we have people like the Shipmans.
Yeah, yeah.
Back in the 30s trying to start up Canadian film production.
Yeah.
But you had numerous people during the 50s and the 60s mm-hmm. start and always falter. So it you could still argue whether Grierson was right.
Yeah.
But the fact is, he had enough sway with the National Film Board that the government never seriously looked into when other countries were doing this, like yeah, in yeah. Europe, government supporting the local film industry, basically because you had Grierson being like, listen, the Americans are good at that. Let the yeah. Americans do that. We're good at documentaries and animation. It's, give the money to us to do what we're good at, and we'll let the Americans do their thing.
It's funny. And like, just, it's, how do I word it? Like I can see his arguments somewhat, yeah.
But and this is at the end of the 1930s yeah. after the Great Depression.
Yeah,
right.
And it wasn't like, yeah, okay, yeah, like the States had the jazz singer, and then like you know Gone with the Wind and all that stuff. But it's just really funny. He was just like film so like still in its like infant phase.
Yeah, we're talking to about the man who coined the term documentary.
Yeah. And he's just like, yeah, we can't do narrative films, and let the States do that. Like, it's just, it's fun. Like, I can see from his perspective in that day and time why he would say that, but also, like, why would you say that?
There is a little bit of self-serving there.
Yeah.
Because he's not saying do not support film. He's saying support the type of films that we make.
Yeah.
And again, he coined the term documentary. He's passionate about that.
Form. Yeah.
And again, he could have been right.
Yeah.
You know, many people have started, but unfortunately there was not the distribution mm-hmm. or the film infrastructure up here to support that.
Yeah.
So maybe if the Canadian government back in the 30s did decide to start putting money
yep.
into local films, it would be bigger. But again, we have this looming country underneath us mm-hmm. that is not only huge economically, but also has a huge film infrastructure and is cranking them out.
Yeah.
Why try to beat the big... This goes back and forth. And yeah. I find funny... Particularly when I listen to podcasts or their YouTube videos about the history of Canadian cinema, Grierson never comes up.
Oh, interesting.
Like, it's funny. Like, my 100 years of Canadian cinema, that goes into Grierson.
Yeah.
But it's funny that the influence of the NFB on the Canadian, and Grierson through the NFB, yeah. the influence on the development of film in this country. And again, the NFB did a lot of great work. This mm-hmm. is not to shit, but it's interesting that there's that detail.
Yeah.
So, again, that's why it really... Until the 70s, with the tax shelter period
yeah.
of the government stepping in, was it basically took until the 70s for any serious film productions to be start to be made in Canada. Yeah. So that's the kind of ground zero of that. So I wanted to bring that up. And the other thing I didn't know that interfered, and this was one of Grierson's arguments, is that film distribution was actually a provincial responsibility. It wasn't a national responsibility.
Yeah, yeah, I know.
So you had to actually negotiate distribution with each individual province.
Yeah, that's something... I learned for like Canadian history, just how the provinces really were legit, like their own mini countries.
Yeah, exactly.
And it was the same in the States too. Like states had their own, like, you know, a criminal could like jump the border to like another state and be totally fine, which eventually that got phased out, of course. But
yeah, but like film distribution was easy because film distribution was with national companies.
Yeah.
Like you wouldn't have to deal with each province as to how yeah, that was going to work. Yeah. For which Grierson said unanimity would be impossible for any sort of a national film network.
Yeah, I don't blame him thinking about that at that time because, again, there would be provinces like, why do we want to invest in this kind of thing, you know?
And again, maybe Grierson was right because, as we're going to get into, the NFB went on to make a lot of great stuff
yeah.
and a lot of recognition for it. So the way that the NFB was set up, it was divided into different units.
Mm-hmm.
So one would be responsible for overseas filmmaking, like new stuff like that. Yeah. One would be local documentaries. Mm-hmm. One that Grierson wanted to start up was an animation unit. And he reached out. We will get into this more in a bit, but he reached out to a former student, an employee, Norman McLaren,
yeah,
to set up the animated film unit in 1942 to produce films and also to train animators.
Yeah.
So a lot of Canadian animators got their start in Canada. We're mm-hmm. doing this animation series. If their teachers weren't with the NFB, their teachers' teachers were probably trained by the National Film Board.
Yeah, yeah.
If you know what I mean, yeah, right? Yeah. Like, that's how influential it is.
Yeah.
And I always forget about that with the National Film Board, that one of its main things was not just to make the films, but to train the people to make the films yeah. as well. So though the animation unit was never a large unit, in the first decade of its existence, it had notable animators such as Colin Lowe, Wolf Coing, Robert Veralt, Evelyn Lambert, George Dunning, and Grant Monroe. They were all recruited in that first decade, and really they served as the unit's backbone for almost 40 years.
Yeah, yeah.
These people stuck around. Now, these other units, I wanted to note, there's one other that I really want to cover. There are a couple of books out there I just haven't been able to track down at a decent price. At
yeah.
I'm not going to spend $80 on a book, right? Would be Studio D, which was specifically for women filmmakers,
mm-hmm.
which was founded in 1974. I have floated around a couple of films made by this unit to do on the show. Just haven't found the right guest yet. But I wanted to bring them up. But again, that just goes to show a point that that NFB is much more than just animation.
And what we're yeah, yeah.
here. Though founded in peacetime, World War II was mm-hmm. right around the corner.
Yeah.
And the NFB's goal was important there, not just to go overseas and to start filming, but also to unify a naturally disunited country. Mm-hmm. about the war and mm-hmm. kind of bring a unified effort towards that propaganda, basically. Yep. Now, this episode is obviously focusing on McLaren and therefore the animation unit. I just wanted to note that we do have to gloss over all the other units, but that's not to say that there weren't other important filmmakers and films that the NFB produced. Not least of all, like I mentioned, the wartime documentaries and the innovations of wartime filmmaking
yeah.
that the NFB really spearheaded. Again, it took us almost 90 episodes to get to talking about the NFB animation unit. Hopefully in the future, we will get around to talking about some of the other aspects of the NFB.
Of course.
Anything you want to bring up before we go on to Norman McLaren?
No, not really. You covered a lot there. Just interesting perspectives. Think that, who knows if maybe... What's his name? I want to say Gustav. I forget his name already.
Grierson?
Thinking of Gustav, the guy who did the plan and sympathy. I think if they didn't listen to him and actually be like, no, let's do, you know, big narrative films in Canada. And who knows how that would have shaped the cinema.
Well, and also keep in mind that a lot of film production in other countries, especially across Europe, really took off after World War II.
This is true, yeah.
Because the knowledge of basically seeing Hitler.
Yeah.
And how well he used film as part of his propaganda machine.
Yeah.
Not just for propaganda, but developing, as we were saying, a national identity.
Yeah.
That's why a lot of European countries started to sink money into supporting their own film industries.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Canada was already really set in their ways with the NFB.
Yeah.
So, you know, but you look at the UK with like Ealing, stuff like that. They had film production beforehand, but really picked
yeah.
up
yeah, yeah.
afterwards. So, again, it's debatable. It's debated by a lot of people. I've talked to some people in the Canadian film industry that if Grierson comes up, they're basically either like, oh, he gave us so much, or yeah. they're literally wanting to spit on the ground and curse his name.
It's just the whole like what if Elseworld kind of thing. Like what could have been?
And again, what do these European countries have that we don't have? Distance from the United States.
This is true.
And a very much more defined culture outside yeah. of being American, which even by the 1930s, Canada was not as distinct as we would like to think, right?
Yeah, I mean...
like, we were already getting American films up here. American studios had a vested interest in keeping it that way, too.
Yeah.
So that's another aspect to bring up. It's a really complicated issue.
Yeah.
That aspect of Canadian film history. All right, so shall we go into Norman McLaren here?
Let's do it. Good old Norman. Go on, Normie.
Norman McLaren was born in 1914 in Stirling, Scotland. He was socially conscious from a very early age, with early memories dropping off Christmas presents to family members in the Glasgow ghettos.
Mm-hmm.
Very poverty-stricken conditions.
Yeah.
So from a very early age, being very aware of wealth disparity.
Yeah.
He attended the Glasgow Art School. There, it is important to note, he did engage in social activism, even at one point joining the local Communist Party.
Mm-hmm.
He started in the visual arts, specifically in painting,
yeah,
and was seeing a lot of promise there. But he also started to see films, an exposure to the type of films that he wouldn't have gotten in his small town of Stirling.
Of course.
Specifically, he saw a film called Studio Number 7 by an animator named Oscar Fischinger. It is an animation of shapes set to Brahms music and inspired him to pursue filmmaking.
Cool.
As he said, he realized film is a medium to express my feelings about music. Which, if you look at a lot of his earlier films, makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, no, definitely. Yeah, he's valid in that, yeah.
Now, in 1933, the school did not have a film club, so McLaren started one by using a borrowed camera.
Okay.
I don't have this in my notes, but one of his old classmates said that if film hadn't existed, Norman McLaren would have invented it as a medium, that he just took to it so quickly right away.
I could see that, yeah.
Now, with no equipment or supplies, McLaren would get inventive, including techniques he would later be known for.
Yeah.
One example to speak of is during the student's day, he would strip old 35mm film stock of its emulsion and produce hand-painted abstractions by painting directly on the clear celluloid. At this time, and you can see this in some of his earlier films, using live-action stop motion,
mm-hmm.
using everyday items.
Yeah.
There's one where there's like a lot of kitchen implements moving about, like one of his old student films, which is kind of neat from the box set.
No, I love the live-action stuff he's done with stop motion.
Now, one of the things that I find interesting about McLaren right out of the gate is that when people talk about film geniuses, they often talk about, look at the fucking Fablemans, man.
You do not like that
Picks
movie.
Up a camera at a young age, and even though he's a dick, he's obviously brilliant. Or, you know, like the film nerds, like the Christopher Nolans.
Yes,
or the Quentin Tarantinos, where we're like, oh my God, he worked in a video store and he just watched every single movie and that was his film school. You never really get these sort of filmmakers that are in love with the materials of film.
Yeah.
Like McLaren starts off and he continues in his career by...
looking at the...
he would refer to it as cameraless filmmaking.
Okay.
That you don't have a camera. You just have the film stock and you work with the film stock and then you project it.
Yeah.
That is insane. Like, that is an aspect of genius filmmaking.
No, it is. It's very...
that he has no comparison.
Yeah.
Not on any sort of scale.
Yeah. Spielberg definitely wasn't like that.
Quentin Tarantino loves film. Norman McLaren loves film, like the actual physical film, which
celluloid,
I find really fucking funny.
The celluloid of it.
Now, this is where John Grierson comes back into the picture, but we're jumping back in time a bit. In 1936, he discovers Norman McLaren at a Scottish amateur film festival where McLaren's films were showing, some of his early student films.
Yeah.
Grierson was the adjudicator of the festival and awarded Norman the top prize.
Wow.
And then he immediately offered him a job at the GPO film unit, otherwise known as the General Post Office film unit.
Yeah.
I brought that up before. The UK's first film unit was actually a division of the post office.
Cool.
And some of the earliest films that they made were propaganda about how great mail is.
Yeah.
Which is pretty funny. But some notable British filmmakers actually got their start working for the post office.
British people, they like their stamps. Okay. They
That's
like
a
them.
Good point.
Yeah.
So Norman McLaren agrees. Because he will have much more access to things like, I don't know, film equipment.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of his like training ground
as
a filmmaker. And thus begins a professional relationship that a colleague described as one of the most fascinating stories.
Yeah.
And that is the professional relationship between John Grierson and Norman McLaren.
Yeah.
When Norman accepted the job, see, this is a Grierson point of view. And this is one thing that's going to stand out. They're very different men.
No, yeah.
Grierson is a bulldog. Norman McLaren is a soft-spoken, arty, socially conscious kid.
Yeah.
Grierson comes into his life and says, you have a lot of imagination, trying all kinds of new things, but totally undisciplined, unharnessed. You don't know how to make a film, and we're going to knock some discipline into you.
He's... yeah. He made the word documentary, so... There you go.
Again, just knowing about Grierson because of the documentary stuff is fascinating, not just Canadian history. So, again, that was McLaren's sort of training ground in that sort of filmmaking, documentary filmmaking, things like that. War was brewing, however, so he left the UK in 1939 at the start of World War II and moved to New York.
Yeah.
Now, in New York was where McLaren started perfecting his cameraless technique that we refer to, where he would scratch, paint, and stipple on film stock. And this is a part I've read so much on McLaren now that I still don't get.
Mm-hmm.
Experimenting with hand-drawn soundtracks.
Okay. Yeah.
Where he does the score by writing and sometimes superimposing photographs on the sound bar.
Yeah, yeah.
So if people don't know at home, you have the film and you think about it with the little pictures.
Yep.
24 frames per second. And then to the left of that, when you're looking at the film the right way, there's a tiny little strip where the sound is.
Yep.
He would write on that to create soundtracks for the films.
Yeah.
When people say filmmaking is magic, sometimes Norman McLaren is, because even when it's explained to me, it's like a magic trick. I don't actually understand how that works or how he did it.
I don't get it either. It's like...
And we will talk about this with some of the films. How he pulls off some of the things that he pulls off is insane.
He's a person that very much benefited from the time period he was born in.
Yes.
Because if he was...
Where
he was doing it, of course. But if he was like just same personality, same everything, same like drive to like political stuff and like, you know, social justice, but born when digital filmmaking was becoming the norm.
Yeah.
Like it'd just be like his talents would be like, I don't know, so wasted. I'm sure he would still come up with some crazy stuff with digital film. No,
for
film,
sure, but...
But it's like he definitely
necessity being the mother of invention.
Yeah.
Like, that's what it is here. Mm-hmm. He started doing this because he didn't have access to cameras.
Yeah.
So he started doing something which seems insane to somebody like you and I.
Yeah.
And we're going to get into this with some of his films, right? Yeah. So...
He puts to shame on a lot of, like, I want to say, like, YouTube and, like, film internet people. Like... That he's just out there doing insane stuff.
It's not even apples and oranges. It's like strange space fruit.
Yeah, he's on his own planet. Oranges. He's on his own planet. Yeah. He's on his own planet, and like we're just there for the ride, basically.
Okay, so it's very interesting to look at McLaren talking about his approach to filmmaking.
Mm-hmm.
He refers, and we talked about how crazy he is. He referred to his films as simple handmade movies.
Okay.
Like, handmade, because he's doing everything by hand, which I find interesting. And maintaining an intimacy with the celluloid.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I don't think you will have any other filmmaker that you talk about that will talk about the intimacy with the actual celluloid itself. Like, again, he's in love with film stock.
Mm-hmm.
As in, it's crazy. Okay. So, somebody around this time is getting a job with the Canadian government and needs to start an animation bureau.
Yeah.
So, Grierson tracked him down in New York. And offered him a job. McLaren agreed on one condition, that he wouldn't have to make any war propaganda films.
Mm-hmm.
We should say at this point as well, and this will come up a bit later, Norman McLaren is not only socially very left-leaning, to which he would probably topple over
thing about his Wikipedia thing is where he went to Russia at a young age. And they solidified his communism. And like in the Wikipedia article, it's like, this disappointed his dad because he wanted him to go there
and be scared off.
And be scared off by it, but he came back even more. It's a little funny.
It's one of those cute stories that I left out because it's already so much. Yeah, yeah. Right? But thank you for bringing that up.
Yeah, That's a very good point. I know his Wikipedia article surprisingly is not as detailed one would hope, but that little sentence there just like is like it's so funny.
It's like
that's just great.
And again, I referred to earlier on in the episode with the books that I have.
Yeah,
I didn't even check out any of the biographies on. Norman McLaren. Mm-hmm. All my information is from like film books, not biographies about him. There are biographies out there. I would have broken my brain if I started to read biographies and distill that. There was plenty of information in what I have.
There's a few that are out of print, unfortunately.
Canadian film books, I've told you, even about filmmakers. But that to point out, he didn't want to make propaganda films because he is also a pacifist.
Yeah, no, exactly. Like it just makes sense. It's just, like that's who he is to his core. Like he just, that's who he is.
So... Here's a good Grierson-ism. Grierson-ism.
Yeah.
Here, I'm stumbling over my words today. I don't know why.
It's a hard word to combine.
Grierson-isms. Okay. Yeah.
Grisms.
So Grierson responded when McLaren accepted the job. He said, come and you will see that you can make cinema as you understand it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not even quite sure what that means. But apparently they were going back and forth by telegram.
Oh, wow.
And that was the response.
Okay.
A lot of places didn't even have connecting phone lines.
Yeah.
And stuff like that, right? Even within North America.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
I thought it was going to be by letter, honestly. So,
telegrams is something that comes up a few times in here, which is kind of funny. So, okay, now we'll talk about the Grierson-McLaren relationship. Again, stark contrast. They're different sides of the coin. One is documentaries. The other is animation.
Yeah.
Right? One of them in documentaries, it's a collective effort
of
a team of people. Animation is a lot of solitary time
mm-hmm.
spent in a dark room. McLaren, we'll get into this, does do collaborative work, but a lot of it is time spent alone. One of the books mentioned one is the king of reality, one is the king of abstraction.
Yeah.
With Grierson and his documentaries. That balance defined what the NFB would be mm-hmm. from there on out as an organization. Practicality, service to the people, but also a place where creatives can do their thing.
Exactly, yeah.
And that balance between the two of them. So obviously McLaren gets a job, founds the animation unit in 1942, where McLaren produced films and taught animation. As we said, that was part of the purpose. Where according to some, McLaren was the only National Film Board member given free rein to make their films with very little interference.
Cool.
Again, though, buddies with Grierson.
Yeah.
Going back a ways. They both come from, I think their hometowns are something like 15 kilometers apart.
Okay.
Where they were from. So, again, maybe Grierson, under somebody else, he wouldn't be given the ability to have the free reign that he did.
Yeah.
Again, this is something we don't know for sure, but there's been a lot of rumors about that. Grierson once claimed McLaren was one of the most protected artists in the history of cinema.
Okay.
Again, he was left up to his own vices for the most part to make whatever he wants and to explore. All government funded.
Yeah.
I mean, like I said, they would get some funds from touring exhibitions and stuff like that and sending the films out there.
But yeah.
It's kind of interesting. But it is also important. This was not something that McLaren took for granted.
Yeah.
He considered himself a civil servant as much as an artist.
Okay.
He understood he had a government job.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, this is something that I wanted to clarify because I kind of asked this myself a little bit before I started doing research. Why animation? And why is this being pushed so much? Why is McLaren being given so much free reign to do what he's doing? Doing groundbreaking animation, unlike anywhere else in the world. We have to make it clear. This is why Canada is known for their groundbreaking animation. It's because Grierson got McLaren from New York to move up to Montreal and to work for the NFB. That's why. Like, it's not even conjecture. That's really why, right?
Yeah.
So, the animation of the NFB was not just considered an artistic extravagance. It was an important part of the National Film Board. As not only were the animations popular with the tours and the theatrical distribution to sell them, so it was a marketing thing as well. And then they could justify making more documentaries and newsreels and things like that because theatrical distributors would mainly buy the cartoons, but they would have to buy these other things as well.
Yeah.
As part of a package, right? So, you know, and it was the norm for theatrical releases to have these beforehand, right? So there is a market for it.
That's how Looney Tunes basically started.
We will be getting back to Looney Tunes. but there was also a growing demand for animation in both instructional films and commercials.
Yeah.
Think about during World War II, the number of animated films. How to keep your cot clean, things like that. How to clean your gun.
Yeah.
Don't speak secrets. You know that one, you never know who's hearing.
Yeah.
Loose lips sink ships. That sort of a thing. So it basically was very, very important for that. And keep in mind, it might look like McLaren is doing a lot of weird, crazy stuff, but he's a teacher teaching the animators that are going out and making the money, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So maybe also that's why he's given free rein, because he's a really good teacher.
Yeah.
Teaching all these animators. And also, in the long run, the NFB's animated output kept up the appeal and engagement with the National Film Board as an institution.
Mm-hmm.
So, like my generation, I brought this up a lot because of the Log Driver's Waltz.
Yes.
That would air on TV a lot, which was with a National Film Board cartoon. You would see that NFBI logo that they have, which is an amazing design.
Yeah,
like, I love that logo design. It goes back for ages. You kind of have a soft spot. So, it's also a PR sort of thing, too, right?
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the national identity, if it was just cold documentaries, it might be like, yeah, whatever, but you bring up the Log Driver's Waltz and people's ears perk up. And this is to keep in mind, we're really doing both for the National Film Board and McLaren up to what is supposed to be the focus of the show, which is Neighbors.
Yeah.
So we brought this up before, but McLaren was a very quiet man who says that he had a quiet existence going back and forth between his home and the NFB offices.
Yeah.
Just kind of drifting back and forth. He was once asked why he didn't do anything political after Neighbors. Like, he didn't do much more, like, political filmmaking.
Sure, yeah.
And we'll get into this. And he's like, I haven't lived enough. He's like, I just don't have enough to say. We will get into why he decided to make Neighbors.
Yeah.
And had the inspiration for that one. But that explains for the entire career, mm-hmm. right? So this goes into how unassuming he is, right? Yeah. He's just like, I'm not going to throw my opinions around because I haven't lived enough.
Exactly, yeah.
Could you imagine if there were more people like that today that were meek enough to keep their own opinions in check? Yeah, because they're like, maybe I don't know what I'm talking about.
Yeah,
kind of inspirational
it
that
is.
Way.
Yeah, no, it you is, know? Yeah.
And the other thing to note is that he had a longtime partnership. A lot of my film books are older, so they would refer to it as an alternative lifestyle mm-hmm. with fellow National Film Board producer and administrator Guy Glover, who McLaren met in London, England in 1937, and they were together until McLaren's death in 1987.
Okay.
So they were together for 50 years. Just another interesting footnote to be in a homosexual relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And from what I can tell, relatively open.
Yeah.
Like, they openly live together. I know there's the old joke of, like, the bachelors living together or the spinsters living together.
Yeah.
So I'm not 100% about how public the relationship was, but I am rather confident that it was, at least by the time McLaren died,
mm-hmm.
that they were quite open about it. Definitely the books is treated as a matter of fact. So just as a couple of final notes about McLaren, I mean, we're going to talk about the legacy of his films a bit later. But in regards to the NFB, one of the quotes of one of the heads of the NFB said, "No other person did more to bring credit to the institution than did this demure, unassuming, pacifist Scotsman."
Mm-hmm.
Now, that is to note, his output is rather eclectic, which will come up when we talk about the films that we are going to be discussing. They can be eclectic in terms of their style, which could hinder accessibility. He doesn't really have, there are phases, but he doesn't really have an overall look
mm-hmm.
to his animations or a lack of a brand, but it shows a very wide artistic expression of what he was willing to pursue. And in regards to the world of animation, this is a good quote. This is actually straight from Cartoon Capers. But I like this up as a summation. In the 40s and 50s, McLaren was an underdog animator, which was dominated by cartoonists. It's interesting that they separate cartoonists and animators.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Important to note. He was the anti-animator of his time, preferring to work with symbols, texture, and color, rather than character design. McLaren's films had marginal release in North America, yet his impact on animation is enormous. He proved beyond a reasonable doubt that animation was not exclusively gigs involving anthropomorphic animals.
Mm-hmm.
He raised the craft from pop culture status to artistic expression. So is now a good time to talk about his films? Okay. Sorry for the deep dive, but you understand, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, you understand why I think that was important to contextualize, especially since most people out there don't really know who Norman McLaren is. Mm. But I think you have an idea of, like, the kind of scope and his importance. Now, in terms of the films, yes, we are mainly talking about Neighbors, but I did want to touch upon a few others because who knows when we're going to get a chance to talk about these again. We are going to be discussing, now, I don't know, do you want to just talk about these in chronological order? Do you want to do Neighbors last?
We should do Neighbors last.
Okay.
That was, air quotes, the focus of the episode. And I feel like I have a lot more to say about Neighbors than the other ones.
Yeah, I don't think we'll talk about the other ones too much in depth. A couple of them might be like, that was fucking cool.
Yeah, that's pretty much it, yeah.
But also for people at home, right?
Yeah.
Like, if you want to get a good berth, this is taken from a couple of lists, ones that were either brought up in one book about in relation to Neighbors, that mm-hmm. they're kind of similar or work with same sort of concepts. And also when I was doing research, Norman McLaren in one interview just fired off three of his favorite films that he made. So I included those in the list as well.
Yeah.
So for those of you at home, and again, these should be free on YouTube, definitely if you're Canadian on the National Film Board site. There is Begone Dull Care, which was made in 1949, produced by McLaren, directed, edited, and animated by Norman McLaren and Evelyn Lambert, and music by the Oscar Peterson Trio,
mm-hmm.
just to get that out of the way. Then we have Neighbors, 1952, produced, directed, animated, and music by Norman McLaren. Then we have Blankety Blank, which is 1955, produced, directed, and animated by McLaren, music by Maurice Blackburn. And then we have A Cherry Tale, 1957, produced by McLaren, co-directed with Claude Jutra. And I will touch briefly upon, there was a little bit of a miscommunication between us. It's my fault. I also just wanted to really briefly bring up Pas de Deux, which he did in 1968. So a little bit after, I just wanted to
bring
up something else. That was on the list of his favorite films that he did. So in going through these, if you're watching along at home, I'm actually going to throw out an asterisk here. It's an honorable mention.
Okay.
If you decide to sit down and just watch them all in one sitting,
yeah,
I would suggest actually starting off with a film called Opening Speech in 1961. Have you seen this one?
I don't think so.
This is the one where it's Norman McLaren in front of a crowd and he's going to give a speech.
Uh-huh.
And then the microphone moves out of the way.
Oh, okay,
and it basically is a long battle with him and the microphone.
Yes, yeah,
of
yeah.
trying different things for him to actually just say welcome.
Yeah.
If you're programming, I'm sure somebody has done this. If you're programming a Norman McLaren film retrospective,
yeah,
it's an obvious thing to have to introduce it, right? But it's also really funny, and it's also neat to see Norman McLaren.
Yeah, no, it is.
In one of his productions. Okay, so as we stated, we will go in chronological order, then we'll loop back around.
Yeah.
And do that one last. Okay. So again, 1949, Begone, Dull Care. It is painted directly on 35 millimeter clear film, frame by frame.
Mm-hmm.
And then other sequences are etched into 35 millimeter black film.
Yeah.
So again, this was produced without using a film camera.
Yeah.
Which is fucking nuts.
I know.
Shall we go back and forth handing off what these films are about? Or what they are, sensibly?
Sure, yeah.
I've been doing a lot of talking, man. You could probably hear it in my voice. Do you want to tackle, since we just watched it, what is Begone, Dull Care?
Oh, man. What is that one? It's jazzy.
It's fucking cool.
It's cool. It's hard to describe these, like the animated films, because like you just have to watch them. But the best way it's the music and the art on the film stock where he's drawing into the film stock.
And interacting in a way I've never seen film and music interact with each other.
So he's like, just really imagine like just scratching into the film stock and then it lining up with the music somehow. And
there were books that try to describe what the process is. I actually wish there was documentary footage of him making the films, because I think I would better understand without going in and just reading a Wikipedia page or out of some of the film books that I have. I don't even quite understand how it works. It did involve, this is to note that this is the one that was co-directed and animated by Evelyn Lambert.
Yeah.
Some points it was a matter of speeding up, slowing down, if things weren't syncing up. Basically, Oscar Peterson, who we should note was 24 at the time.
Okay.
Oscar Peterson, acclaimed Canadian jazz pianist.
Mm-hmm.
As I said after we watched it, the song's a fucking bop.
It is, no.
Now, Oscar Peterson was approached after McLaren had heard some of his music.
Yeah.
And basically, after watching some of McLaren's films, the Oscar Peterson trio improvised based on some of the films that they saw. And then McLaren would go back and sometimes they would have to redo if things didn't line up. But sometimes it was a matter of slowing the film stock down, slowing it up when they did eventually put it onto film.
Yeah.
And like a solid film stock that wasn't what he physically painted on. They would have to transfer it. Again, technical stuff. I wouldn't even begin to talk with any sort of authority. What I find interesting is that that film is the only place where that song exists.
Okay.
Because it was done with the National Film Board and government funds, it never ended up on Oscar Peterson's albums.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
Right? So that's the only place to hear that song. And it's great. It's colors, and then it'll shift to black lines.
Yeah.
I have to note my favorite part. I'm explaining this to James with my fingers. But if you watch it, you'll know what I'm talking about. There's one scene where the music really starts to slow down and then stops.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have two white lines on a black background slowly coming together. And they touch right at the point where the music kicks up again. And I smile. I grin ear to ear every single time I see that. It might be one of my favorite moments in any animated film, period.
It's pretty much picture like those black pieces of paper where you scratch with your nail and there's like color behind it.
That's exactly what it is.
That's what
that is exactly what it is.
Yeah. For anyone at home trying to picture this chaos we're talking about. But yeah, it's just like, you have to watch it to really understand it, but it's just like, it keeps your attention. At least it kept my attention. I never really wanted to look away and be like, oh, I'm going to look at my phone or do this or that.
Yeah.
It's like, oh man, I really, again, back to what I said before, I really wish I had a class in school, especially one of my art classes, was like, hey guys, look at this. And I would have been probably like just speechless right now, basically as a kid being like, what am I watching? This is so crazy and awesome.
And every single one of these, when I watch them, it makes me really want to see these in a dark theater projected with like really good sound. Like I was saying with this Oscar Peterson song, just really good, like loud stereo in a theater with these colors and images popping in front of you would just be, it would almost be transformative. Mm-hmm. And to think about it, like in 1949, you could just like walk in and Northern Ontario, possibly.
Yeah.
And just sit down and have this shown in front of you.
Yeah.
By one of these traveling tours, right? You could see this before a movie, possibly. Mm-hmm. Which is fucking nuts. That would get me jazzed for pretty much any movie.
Yeah.
No pun intended. But the thing I like about this, and the reason why this is my favorite one out of all of these, is the sort of idea of showing the absolute melding of two different art forms.
It is, yeah.
It is a visual representation of the music, just as much as the music is a soundtrack to the images that you're seeing. They are one and the same.
Yeah.
And it is an amazing work of art.
It is.
This might, if we're talking about film as art, this might be my favorite movie that we've done on the show, period.
Yeah.
Just as a piece of art. If it's a piece of moving images that you would hang on your wall like a piece of art,
yeah,
it's Beyond Doll Care.
Mm-hmm.
And it is widely considered one of the most popular NFB shorts, especially animated of all time.
I can see why.
Again, yeah. Okay, let's move on. I don't think the other ones will be as long, but let's go through here. With what we set up, the next one is Blankety Blank, released in 1955, which is visuals etched directly onto 35mm black film.
Mm-hmm.
And the sound was recorded by Maurice Blackburn and a string quartet, which I think is really neat. It's improvised classical music.
Okay.
Apparently, there is some sort of a score, but on the sheet music, there would actually be options of what other notes they could play.
Okay.
Which is kind of cool as well. Like, cool, there's experimentation on all sorts of levels here. So it's not spinning out of control, but it was so funny before I rewatched it. Like, I'd seen this years ago. I was like, improvised music? I was expecting jazz, but then they were talking about strings.
Yeah.
Which you don't really think of unless you're like Stefan Grappelli with Django Reinhardt. You don't think a lot about improvisational, like, strings, especially in a quartet, but that's how they did it. It's just images, what we were talking before about the etching on the film stock, that's pretty much completely what it is.
It's very like fire. It looks like fireworks, basically.
A little bit.
That's like the one way I would describe it. And there's, I guess, a story there somewhere. I'm sure like it's kind of like up to your own interpretation, whether or not this is just like sounds and colors. But like you can definitely like, I don't know, think of like a narrative in there.
Well, one thing that was important for this, as an exercise for McLaren, is that when he was working on it, he realized that he needed to embrace the blackness.
Okay.
That unlike narrative film, when you're shooting on film stock, unless something is taking place in a dark room, you're always going to have an image in front of you.
Yeah.
And he really, for this one, set out to be like, okay, I'm going to embrace the blackness and have that as part of the storytelling that you can do with the type of films that he's making that you can't normally with others.
Mm-hmm.
Like, unless somebody's in a black room, like a completely dark room in a narrative film, that's one thing, but you'll never have it as a storytelling device partway through just to make everything black.
Yeah.
For no reason other than for effect.
Yeah.
As to what you're seeing, you won't see that. You'll never see a Christopher Nolan film that for no other reason will just go black.
Yeah.
For like 10, 15 seconds and then just resume.
Mm-hmm.
As much as people say Tenet was crazy, Nolan's not going to do that, right? Not explain it to the audience. So that gives him that freedom. So that's him really leaning into the whole etching thing. And I think that's why it was really important, even though that's in Beyond Doll Care. This is like the more extreme version of that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it really works well with the music.
It does. It's just,
it's really an extension of what he does in Beyond Doll Care. It's almost a minimalist version of that.
Yeah, very much so, yeah.
It's not as explosive as Beyond Doll Care. It's more meditative and you kind of go back. But again, to see this in a dark cinema and just to have these like white images just kind of flittering like around the screen to the music would be absolutely incredible. And then we have A Cherry Tale, released in 1957, clocking in at 9 minutes and 52 seconds. I'll take this one. It's basically a guy getting into a fight with a chair
because
the chair won't let him sit on
it. This one's live action for people at home. It's not
traditional. There are elements of animation.
Oh, 100%. Yeah, it's not like traditional, what you would think, like illustration.
Yeah.
I mean, putting the word traditional in front of Norman is like, doesn't work. It's very, like, theater-esque. It definitely, I'm not sure if he was inspired by certain theater movements in Europe. I mean, he could have been.
Nothing like that came. I'm not saying no, but I'm just saying.
There's very like a sense of like Brecht, or not Brecht. And I know Brecht was a theater person, but it's like pretty much a guy has a fight with a chair. And then on the Wikipedia article, there's a lovely interpretation one where one's like pacifism. And everyone is like, this is about queer relationships.
There are a lot of takes. Yeah, definitely.
But no, it's fun. It's fun. It's a fun one. Like a guy fights with a chair and like it's cute. Yeah.
Yeah. So the chair is manipulated by sometimes just basic string pulling it across. We will get to this. There is some pixelation.
Yeah.
Being done basically the frame by frame animation of the human interacting with the chair, which again is a technique we'll get to because it basically is what defines Neighbors and why that one is actually an animated film, even though you don't think it is at first. Reverse variable speed, live action. We have to mention the soundtrack is Ravi Shankar.
Okay. Yeah.
The famous sitar player that was really big in the 50s and 60s. Very influential on the Beatles, obviously.
Yep.
Now, they were basically just... They were playing, I believe, in Montreal for a show. And then they were just approached, and they were so delighted by the film. Like, the film had been completed by that point. They just didn't have a soundtrack.
That's nice.
They agreed to record the soundtrack
for it.
So that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
It's funny, McLaren said... I don't even know what this means. There's a lot of McLarenisms when he's talking about his films. He was talking about A Cherry Tale, and he said... Well, obviously, a chair is a symbol of exploitation. Is it? Because we sit on it all the time, like the poor unappreciated. Is my couch feeling sad right now that we're sitting on?
That is a reading for like, I mean, it could be about like, I don't know, humans just being lazy, I guess. Who knows?
Again, there's a lot. It's kind of like Neighbors that. You can just take it at face value if you want to, or 100%. You can think deeper into it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very surface level.
Yeah.
But anyways, he fights with the chair. They kind of go back and forth. You have to see it again. You can see it for free. It's like 9 minutes.
Yeah.
And then he eventually learns that the chair just wants to sit on him for a bit.
Yeah.
To have the tables turn, which is where you're talking about the queer thing comes up.
Yeah.
Now, okay, I'm going to be a downer just for a second because this is my opportunity to talk about something.
Okay.
That has been addressed and... addresses possible other episodes.
Yeah.
Do you know who his co-director and who the main actor Claude Dutra is?
No.
He went on to possibly be the most influential filmmaker in Quebec history.
Okay, yeah.
He is most known in most circles for directing Mon Oncle Antoine.
Yeah.
I've made reference to that film a few times because I always joke we'll do, you know, schlocky tax shelter era films. We'll do High Point. We'll do Prom Night, but we've never done Mon Oncle Antoine, which is commonly in the top 10 of the best Canadian films ever made. Mm-hmm. The Sight and Sound poll that the Toronto International Film Festival does every year for like 30 years after it was made.
Yeah.
It was kind of like Citizen Kane. Mon Oncle Antoine was always number one.
Yeah.
Like the best Canadian film of all time. Mm-hmm. He was revered in Quebec so much that the award for the best Quebec film of the year was called the Jutra.
Okay.
I'm not going to say get into it here, but you can look it up if you want. But after his death, he was accused of some very horrific things.
Okay.
This is one of the reasons, because I have had a couple of people write in when they give lists of films to suggest for episodes, bring up on Uncle Antoine.
Yeah.
Because he happens to be here. That's the only reason why I bring it up here, because Claude Dutra was one of the co-directors. Yeah, he was working at the National Film Board at the time before he went back to Quebec to make feature films and documentaries.
Yeah.
I don't think I'm ever going to do Mon Oncle Antoine.
Mm-hmm.
Not because, you know, you can separate the art and the artist, but a big part of the show is exploring the filmmakers.
Yeah.
Their history, their importance to Canadian cinema. And I do not really want to go in. I don't even want to research somebody that the entire time I'm researching it, I'm like, this dude's a fucking monster.
Yeah.
And nor do I want to elevate them or praise even their work on this show by doing that. But just to state it, in one article that I read, it was basically cited the most immediate fall from grace of any celebrity to the point that even when it was just accusations.
Yeah.
And as far as I know, it's still just accusations because he's dead.
Yeah.
Like there's no one to go on trial or to be charged with for any of this stuff.
But normally that's what happens when the person passes away. That's when it's like,
but
they can actually now immediately tell their story.
Immediately the day after, the Quebec Film Board reversed the decision to have the Jutra be the name for the award.
Yeah, yeah.
The next day, and immediately larger cities like Montreal
immediately
started to change street signs.
Okay, wow. That's
public dedications, things like that, because it was such a huge celebrity. The article that I mentioned said it was like overnight he was literally, as much as possible, wiped.
Wow.
From the face of Quebec culture.
I mean, Quebec is, yes, they're, they don't want, you know, stir up the Quebecois separatist movement, but really they are their own, like, kind of like mini country.
They are. And like I said, he was a big deal. Yeah. You know, imagine if the Best Picture Oscar every year was called the Spielberg.
Yep.
Or the Scorsese.
Yeah.
They would never do that because you can't really put one in front of the other. Like, you'd never call it the Hitchcock.
No, no.
Or the Wills. Not to drive the point home, but he was a big enough influence that that's what the name Main Prize was named after. Anyways, again, apologies. I didn't want to be a downer, but this might be the only time Claude Jutra comes up in the show.
That's fair. That's,
and I wanted to address here why I will probably never cover what some people consider the best Canadian film ever made.
Yeah.
It and Porky's are now the two films off the table that I will never cover on this show. And again, to explain, I just don't want to research Claude Jutra.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you, James. No worries. I knew I wanted to bring that up because people have brought up doing that film, and that's why that will be a forever blind time. Our blind spot in the show. And then the final film, Miscommunication, you didn't see it. It's not that big of a deal. It's not even animated. Pas de Deux, he cited as one of his favorite films. Mm-hmm. It's one of his best known ones. Pas de Deux is in ballet when two dancers mirror each other, their movements.
No, I just like the way you say duh. This is,
duh.
You really hit it like, pas de deux.
I am an Ontarian.
You are.
Anglo.
You are.
That when I go home, people are like, is that Scotian accent sneaking in there? So there's going to be some abominations of pronunciations that come out of my mouth sometime.
Pas de deux.
Thank you, James. I will get you to say everything French in the future.
You might as well. I was in French immersion and, like, you know, it works.
Okay, so it's basically a live-action film of two dancers dancing with each other, but there's a lot of blur lines, slow motion. It's really a study of movement and anatomy.
I love this short.
You have seen it?
I've seen it. Oh, yeah.
Okay. I thought you didn't watch it for this, but you had seen it in the past.
Yeah.
Okay, understood. Yeah,
that's
okay.
What I meant. That's like that, like a refresh, because he has so much stuff out there.
And again, we're scratching the surface.
Yeah.
Again, I wanted to talk about more than just one
film. Yeah, I wish I rewatched it to give me a refresh. But
And this is in 1968, a lot later in his career, a lot of later discs in the set I didn't have a chance to get to.
Yeah.
He did start becoming a lot more interested in anatomy and movement and dance and stuff like that, particularly in the 70s and 60s, late 60s, early 70s.
Like, this is like, my dear stuff at Dow was very much against film. They're like, oh, film is just terrible. Film is not real theater. I'm like, screw you. Like, I would have loved, like, my dance classes at Dow to talk about, like, just show, like, Norman stuff. It's like, oh, it's, that's another story in itself.
So you like this one?
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. Okay. Sorry.
I like all the stuff. Like,
oh, yeah. Everything that I've seen. Yeah. Even some of the test footage.
Yeah. Like,
because the set that I have has a ton of test stuff as well.
It's, he just is such a fascinating person that I'm so sad he passed away. Died in his 60s or?
He was 71, I believe.
71, which is still pretty young.
But that's a good run.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, obviously, right now, he'd be, way too old. Even when I was born, 1994, he'd be, approaching it there. But, even some of, the stuff, even some of the shorts he doesn't like, I'm assuming, are still, worth watching. It's, just...
Oh, and we'll get into this. He's
Your brain. How does your brain work? He's not
somebody to have an ego about his own.
That's the thing. Doesn't have really when he should have had an ego, because the stuff he made is literally, you said, is magic. It's holy shit.
Yeah, like I said, my brain breaks when it comes to doing the score on the film.
Yeah.
We're going to get into this with Neighbors.
Yeah.
It is literally something, like I said, it's like me watching a magician do a trick right in front of me. And I'm like, you could tell me how you did that, but
illusions.
How does misdirection fool an entire room?
Yeah.
You know, there's still a part of your brain that doesn't get
what
they're actually doing.
100%.
Okay, shall we talk about Neighbors?
Yes.
Unfortunately, it's back to me reading at you for a circuit. But this is the background of Neighbors, where it came from. So, in the 1950s, McLaren was in China for 4 months with UNESCO.
Yeah.
after Mao Zedong came to power with the Chinese Revolution.
That's another thing. Just to interrupt there, it's crazy. He's been part of these like world events.
Yeah,
like, he was in China when Mao became a thing. He was definitely in Russia when just after, you know, like Lenin took down the czars and brought in like the stuff. And for Stalin, it's like, it's crazy. Like, this dude is just like,
and socialist area.
Yeah. Too. So it's just like, what?
He was there teaching a group of Chinese artists simple animation.
That's nice.
To teach rural populations the importance of health and sanitation.
Yeah.
Now, to explain, UNESCO is a United Nations agency that travels and educates populations in education, sciences, and the arts.
Yeah.
It was founded in 1945, and one of their big roles now, which I can appreciate, is that they secure World Heritage Sites.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think that is very cool, and being somebody who likes architecture and is a very big fan of preserving those, I think they do a very good service.
Don't say that in Nova Scotia. You'll be called a NIMBY.
I'm very much for preserving Nova Scotia buildings as well. Now, while he was there, McLaren had a great empathy for the Chinese people. He was impressed with the excitement and enthusiasm that the young people he was working with had about their future.
Yeah.
But he did not like the general consensus back home that China was the enemy because of their support for North Korea as a Korean War was in progress.
That is true. And Canada was part of the Korean War.
We were.
Yeah.
Also, when McLaren returned to the National Film Board, it was at that time under attack by McCarthyites.
Oh.
Within the government.
Okay, I didn't know that. Wow.
When I say McCarthyites, obviously it's like when people talk about Trumpers in Canada.
Yeah, yeah.
People that are seeing what's going on in the States and that sentiment leads up here. This is not a new thing.
Yeah, 100%.
My step-grandmother on my father's side was a WAC. The woman was a WAC, like with the Women Army Corps.
Yeah.
And she basically was forced to quit when she refused to give up names of people that she knew that might be communists.
Yeah, yeah.
So that happened in Canada as well.
Oh, yeah, I knew that happened. But it's kind of
Got along with my step-grandmother, but I respect her for that.
Yeah, yeah.
And it got so bad at one point, director Greta Ekman, that we brought up earlier, was fired while supervising the film Whirligig because of her communist ties.
Mm-hmm. The witch hunts, they were...
And like I said, it never gets talked about, but it happened in Canada
too. I know, like again,
it
like...
It happened in Canada
too. Like you said, like the politics... I could have spent a lot of time just talking about nationalism in Canada during World War II. I did a lot of like essays on that in high school and junior high.
Maybe when we start getting into the NFB's war coverage and films. If you ever want to go into that, that's the place to do it.
Because they went at home. Literally, World War II, UK enters the war against Germany. The day after, Canada was right there.
Yeah.
Because it was a big like, hey, we're our own country now. We're not like, because World War I, everyone was forced to do it because the monarchy.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just kind of crazy. Like when you grow up as a kid, like, oh, we're so different from the Americans. It's like, no, not really. Like, it's like...
Much like their film was bleeding up here in their culture, the same way the politics does.
Yeah.
You know, so...
And the
and like I said, you hear about this, think about the last few years.
And CanCon completely failed to fix it.
We just got a lot of Kim Mitchell and Bryan Adams.
Yeah.
Okay, so back to this. So the experience of working in China during the revolution... And seeing a valued colleague get fired due to their political beliefs inspired him to make a short with a political stance.
Yeah.
As we said before, he generally had the point of view that he hadn't experienced enough or wasn't learned enough to make anything political or make any social commentary, but he was inspired to in this instance. Yeah. So at this time, he was starting to experiment with pixelation.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to say what pixelation is? As I had to explain to a friend the other day, it has nothing to do with computers.
Yeah.
Because nowadays you immediately think computer pixel.
Yeah, I know.
Like, you almost think pixelation is just an image that looks pixelated.
I might have to get an actual proper definition because I feel like I'm going to be bad at it. I'm not good at descriptions for some things.
Do you want me just to take it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The best quote that I saw was animating live humans by single framing human motion.
Yeah.
Instead of filming 24 frames a second.
Yeah.
So essentially, taking a photo of an actor, move slightly, take a photo.
It's stop motion.
It is.
That's what I would have, but it's like, it's more than just that.
Which is why it's funny that a lot of people will say, and we'll get into this, that it's not animation.
Yeah.
It's live action, but it is animation.
It isn't,
In the same way that stop motion is animation.
Yeah, that's why it's like, it's like, it's stop motion, but it's like, that's kind of like a layman's term for my hand to tell somebody. It's like, which it doesn't, I don't want to say it does like disservice saying that pixelation, but it's just like, it's just, sometimes that's how you have to describe stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just like, you just,
And essentially what it does is that it makes the actors' movements look stylized and kind of unnatural.
Yeah.
Which, like, kind of jerking the way that they're moving and stuff like that.
Which is what I love about this short film, Neighbors, is like that janky movement. And when you see them out of the janky movement, you're like, whoa, hey, it's like, go back to that. It's like, I'm in this world now.
We're going to talk about some of the scenes that I really like. Yeah. The style of Neighbors was happened upon by accident.
Okay.
While making test footage using dancers performing a square dance using the pixelation process, he noted that it didn't look like they were dancing, but they were trying to, quote, duke it out.
Okay. I can believe that.
Note that McLaren gets referenced as a pacifist a lot, as we already brought up. He also liked the idea that using pixelation, he could film a fight without having to film the actors actually perform a violent act.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Listen, fight choreography is like, it takes a lot of time. Like,
well, that, and you're still, even if you're not connecting, you are still doing a violent act.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. Whereas with pixelation, there is no violent act actually occurring.
Yeah.
So as a pacifist, that appealed to him as well.
Yeah.
Kind of cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Good on you.
So when it was brought up to McLaren to make a film by one of the producers, it came to him full-fledged. He knew right away. After the images that he had seen doing the pixelation, it was like immediately, this is what we're going to do. What is Neighbors?
It's a flower that two men fight over.
It's an allegorical tale.
I know. I know. It's anti-war.
Yeah, it's basically two neighbors at the beginning are getting along just fine.
Yeah, yeah.
And then a flower pops up.
And they want the flower.
And they both want the flower, to which they essentially, we'll talk about some of the beats, but they essentially, it escalates and escalates and escalates them fighting over this flower.
Yeah.
It's a very simple parable.
Yeah, yeah.
It almost seems quaint in how sort of straightforward it is, but it is 1952. Even stating anti-war sentiments at the time was very not popular. Like, in the States, you would be called un-American, of un-American activities.
Yeah.
Do we really need to explain McCarthy and the witch hunts? I think we've explained a lot. If you don't know what that is, look it up.
Wikipedia. Just Wikipedia witch hunts. Just, like, Americans didn't like communism in Hollywood. People got ratted out.
And they use it as an excuse to do a lot of shitty things. Yeah. Much like right now. Yeah. A lot of causes are just being an excuse to do a lot of shitty things.
And then the word neo-McCarthyism came a thing. Yeah. I mean, you say quaint, but really, like, halfway through the film,
quaint in idea.
Okay, yeah. Right? Yeah.
Like, we'll talk about that.
Yeah.
But quaint in idea. But, you know, it seems almost hippie-ish, but it's 52, right?
Yeah.
So there's
no hippie movement.
There's a sort of earnestness.
Yeah.
About it. And like I said, to be anti-war this soon after World War II, while Canada is at war.
Yeah.
In Korea, might not be a popular thing to do.
No.
So again, we've brought this up a lot on the show recently, context of when the film was made as well.
Yeah.
1952, kind of interesting.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of any big history moments aside from like the Korean War, but also like the States would also start ramping up with the Vietnam War in the late 50s, because that's when France kind of like ducked out.
Yeah, that slowly escalated over a period of time too. Okay, so really with the way that the film played out, was the impact of the Korean War going on at the time?
Yeah.
As he said, two good people fighting each other,
because
he did have such a good experience while he was in China, basically violence stirred up by ideology.
Yeah.
And that's the only reason why these two good groups of people are killing each other.
Yeah.
Just a few brass tacks about making. There really isn't a lot there because it's pretty straightforward. Film fellow animators Jean-Paul Lodese and Grant Monroe as the two neighbors, and Wolf Coing, who we brought up earlier, served as cinematographer.
Mm-hmm.
Don't worry, nothing problematic about any of those gentlemen that I have to bring up. Shall we talk about the film itself before we talk about reception and afterwards?
Sure, yeah.
So, is this your favorite out of the five?
I definitely say it would. It'd be my favorite. No, it's more...
I mean, they're all so different.
It's my favorite of his for live action. Quote.
Live action, yeah.
Quote, air quotes there, people. Live action shorts he did. Animation is completely different. Like, that might have to be... Ooh, that's tough word from animation. But it's definitely my favorite for like using like, you know, real humans on the camera, in front of the camera. That's probably the best way to describe his live action stuff is humans in the camera.
Now, again, you can see this for free. It's 8 minutes of your time.
Yeah.
If you haven't seen it before. The brass tacks is that it is pixelation, frame by frame animation of human beings using variable speed and reverse live action.
Mm-hmm.
Frame by frame animation of objects. Again, the audios of the film it scratches directly on the edge of the film on the soundtrack.
Yep.
Is where the sound comes from. Yep. And basically just animating people.
Yeah.
As an exercise. So it starts off with, I wrote down bros and chairs. I have to say right out of the gate, I love the design of the houses themselves.
Yeah.
They're obviously two like plywood painted fronts, like just propped up behind them. I wish I could get an enamel pin.
Okay.
That was just one of those houses.
That's cool.
Recreated. I don't know what goes into making an enamel pin. I did a quick little search. The NFP is kind of missing on merch. But I think it would just be a really cool,
the shirts.
Really specific thing of my interest in doing the show would be to have a little pin of one of those houses.
I'm probably not an animal. Yeah, sorry. Now I'm slurring my words.
It's like fucking Pontypool.
Yeah. Enamel pins, but definitely clay pins. You could definitely do, I think that'd probably be easier. Like, I have a few clay pins.
I keep threatening my friends to get a bottom press.
Yeah.
So maybe it's not quite the same thing, but just the graphic design of it is so cool.
I'm sure you can commission somebody.
Yeah, the graphic design of it is so cool.
Yeah.
That I just think it would make a nice little pin, right? So anyways, that was a me thing.
Yeah.
Like, immediately, like, I love those houses. I would have that on a pin.
Yeah. They're quaint. They're cute.
Now, they're hanging out. They're sitting on their nice little foldable chairs. I did really think a couple of times that it's like, yeah, those are just two dudes from the 50s.
Yep.
With their hair and their clothes. Yep. You can tell that they just wear whatever they would wear to work.
Yeah.
And they're just fucking around probably in the backyard of where the NFP offices was. I think I read somewhere they filmed it over a month.
Okay.
Yeah.
That makes sense. That's
but that's their fucking job.
Yeah.
And you think about it, it is only 8 minutes long.
Yeah.
Some of those day shoots would be very exhausting, and we'll get to those in a second. And then at which point the flower props up, I crack up every single time that the flower comes up, because not only does the flower like shoot up from the ground, it does a little flirty dance.
I know.
I like the idea that the like flower is kind of being a little bit sexy.
I like, yes.
Being bloop, bloop, bloop.
Well, that's what the sounds too.
I love his little wiggly dance.
Every time the flower dances, which is basically, it's basically just a fucking dandelion that they're fighting over. So it's so kind of funny that in that context. But I love the little, like you said, the bloops it does when it does this little, like, kind of wave dance.
One of the chapters that I read in one of my books said that McLaren was even an electronic music pioneer.
Because it's
1952.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that.
Computers are not a thing yet. When do really super huge computers start being a thing? Is that, like, late 50s? I'm not a computer expert.
It was the 50s when, like, big computers were becoming a thing, like...
Like, they definitely were by the 60s and the
moon. Oh, yeah, by the 60s, yeah. But, but they were being used in the 50s. Like, that's what, like, for military stuff.
But again, I don't know how this works. Again, film as magic. That sound is made by him doing etches.
Yeah.
Like, it is so in sync.
Yeah.
It matches so well the movements.
I know.
How do you even fucking calculate that?
I don't know.
Again, you can see the pile. I've been open about the books that I use.
There's a lot of books there, people.
I still don't quite. Again... It's magic. I don't understand how that works. But anyways, apparently McLaren was an electronic music pioneer. You can draw a straight line to him and Trent Reznor and Atticus Finch and their soundtracks to their films.
Yeah.
And you know what? I said that as a joke, but it's not true.
It's not. No. It's, I would say he's definitely him being a pioneer for electronic music. Yeah, 100%.
Okay. And then obviously they both fall in love with the flower. That's where some of the kooky stop motion animation things start coming in. I kind of like when they're on the ground and they're moving around like a snake.
Yeah.
That's kind of a cool effect. And the flower, I mean, again, you could read into this sort of stuff in many ways. It could be like the two neighbors could be two countries fighting over a natural resource.
Yeah.
Or it could just be two dudes that like their little flirty flower that does a little dance and goes bloop, bloop, bloop,
bloop, bloop, bloop
at them. Again, even when I was watching it today, I fucking crack up at the dance the flower does.
Mm-hmm.
That should be a GIF.
Yeah.
You know, just put that at the bottom of every single one of your messages there. Okay, so when I said some of those days must be long, I love the effect of them flying.
Oh, yeah, that's great.
It looks like that, their legs are just up in there and they're going blah, 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 blah. Yeah. But you obviously know how they did that.
No, I can't.
They would just take pictures. They would have to jump.
They'd be jumping,
over and over again.
Yeah.
So they'd have to jump, tuck their legs behind them, snap, and then they would have to... Step over.
I thought you were going to say they actually had some wires going.
Jump in the air. No wires at all. Just jumping, how they would do that. Their flying techniques is that they would have to jump up every single time.
At the
time,
right time, yeah.
And then they would have to time it and make sure they took the photograph at the same time.
Yep.
I'm just saying your legs would be pretty fucking tired at the end of that day. cool effect when the fence comes down between the two houses, when literally decide to build the fence. That's why when I first brought this up to you, I misremembered and I thought it was
Fences. Yeah, you called it Fences,
which is a Denzel Washington film.
It is, yeah.
And then I had to look up and be like, oh, fuck, no, it's called Neighbors. I thought for years, when I wasn't doing research anything and I hadn't seen this for ages, I think that's why I thought it was called Fences.
Yeah.
Was the effect of the fence sort of building itself and kind of going back and forth between the houses.
So, so like they build the fence up and then there's a little tug of war where like, oh, the fence is on my side and you don't get the flower. Now it's on, and it's just like, just the time to do that too.
Now, like, when did, I should have brought this up earlier. When was the first time that you saw Neighbors?
It was, I want to say either late 2011. I was definitely grade 11. So it was either end of first semester and fall of 2011 or the beginning of 2012. Because that's when I was really kind of starting to like, I never really had a film bro phase, but like, unfortunately my era of the internet was filled with just people who should not have mouthpieces or soapboxes, basically.
Which also coincides with like film boards and Twitter and stuff like that.
Basically, it was kind of me going from like David Lynch, starting to like explore David Lynch. Mm-hmm. So I think I just like, I watched it.
God, I never even thought about it. You can definitely see some Neighbors.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. 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 Like, you
did Lynch.
Yeah. Yeah. Lynch had like Lynch source films. Like,
yeah.
You definitely can. Yeah. Let's just say 2012, beginning of 2012 is when I first came across.
And you just saw it online or?
Online. It was it was a English teacher who told me about it. And she's like,
oh, okay, cool.
And Miss Brick was her name. Or that wasn't her actual, her name was Brickadin. She's like, just call me Miss Brick. And she's just like, yeah, like, you should, like, look into this. Like, she didn't know anything about Norman McLaren.
Yeah.
But she just, she liked to let people know more about Canadian stuff.
That's good.
Yeah.
More of what you were regretting not having more of.
Yeah. And she knew I was, like, a big, like, arts person, too.
Yeah. Yeah, for me, I don't know. I might have seen it on TV Ontario at some point. Like, I have known about this film for a very long time, possibly since childhood.
If I saw this on television, just Nova Scotia, I would have been so awestruck and dumbfounded by it. I've been like, what?
Now, keep in mind, it was probably a version that we'll get to later in the It is kind of neat how when things escalate, the face paint.
Oh, God, yeah.
That goes on to the actors.
I always forget about it every time. And because, like, you think it's two people fighting over a flower, and then all of a sudden, it's just like, insane face painting. Yes. It's just like, whoa. Like,
which again would be very labor.
Yeah.
It, like,
it's detailed face painting. It's not like just like little.
Yeah, whatever. And to do it with the pixelation effect over time. But that also enables for the paint to grow and move around the face. So he's animating using the paint on the actors' faces.
Yeah.
Which is kind of cool.
Because it's going to get smudged. They're on the ground and stuff.
He's literally using the humans as canvases.
Yeah. Yeah.
To animate onto.
Yeah.
And you could really only do that with pixelation.
Yeah.
Kind of cool.
It is cool. Like,
I actually didn't even really think about that before this moment. Then obviously, they trample the little flirty flower fighting with each other. We could all see that coming. Here is the controversial scene.
Yes, yes.
They basically go rip up the houses where there is a wife and child laying there, at which point they murder each other's wife and child. Even one comedically where he kicks the wife and the wife starts shooting across the ground like the snake that I said before. You're laughing, I know, but it is pretty brutal.
It is brutal. That's the thing. It's brutal, but it's also just the way they do it. It's just like, it's just so funny. Like,
you're right. And then we'll just wrap up going through the beat by beat. Because you really need to see it to get it.
Oh, like, really that's basically Mormon stuff. Is like, you have to see it. Like,
and then they kill each other and then they turn into graves.
Mm-hmm.
Where the old fence that was dividing kind of
comes back,
goes around, becomes the cross on top of the grave and the fence around them.
Yeah.
And then a little flower.
Two flowers come back.
Grows out of each of their grave. The end. On that note, it's just a fun watch. I'm so glad we finally got over to talking about that film and McLaren.
It's very funny because, like, when I was watching it last night, when I was rewatching them, I was sitting there like, wow, it's like The Simpsons would do a bad joke about this, because the Simpsons writing team would make fun a lot about like European arts house, and because there's that one episode of Simpsons where it's like Itchy and Scratchy, but the European version, and it's very like, you know, almost like a Norman McLaren like animation.
Yeah.
And it's just like kind of the writers be like, oh, the Europeans are so pretentious kind of thing. It's like, that's what I feel like the Simpsons would look like, would make fun of this kind of thing, you know, being like, oh,
there is an earnestness to
it.
But when you realize that it was done by a very frustrated, quiet, brilliant gay man. So, and we're not even bringing up the alienation that would involve in culture in the 1950s. A dude who
established right away that he was a communist, a socialist at least.
Making this message that is anti-war. And I find it funny that he's taking that frustration, and you can imagine anger, and turning it into an anti-war message as opposed to using it as an instigator to get angry and inflict that anger onto somebody else.
Yeah.
You know, the old adage that he decides to preach love, I suppose. And we do have to mention that at the beginning and the end of the movie, it does the message in like multiple different languages.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
So he meant for it to be like a universal one with those messages. He said, this is a message for the world.
Yeah.
Not just for Canadians and not just Americans. I forgot to point out the other cute thing is that you saw the newspapers at the reading at the beginning.
Yes, one it's like a war. There's no peace without war. There's no
peace certain if no war. And the other one says war certain if no peace.
Yeah, yeah.
Again, you can think on the nose, but again, 1952
really
gives it a lot of slack. This is not John Lennon doing a bed-in sort of thing. This is an artist frustrated with the world around him and using groundbreaking technology and animation to try to put a positive message in the world because he doesn't like the world that he's looking at. This is not a team of animators. This is one artist's vision.
Yeah, I know. And it's like...
to do, which you almost never get in any film. Like, you almost never get, like, one artist's exact vision. It's him and the cinematographer and the people that he's telling what to do.
And it was the first one that won the Oscar, right?
We will get that.
Okay, okay, cool.
We will get
that. But it's like...
It's not the first Canadian film to, I believe it is the second?
Yeah.
National Film Board. I think one of their documentaries won before this.
Yeah.
But again, we'll get into that.
Yeah, but it's like such a like, it's only 8 minutes, and like maybe it's because the two men at the beginning are dressed in that stereotypical 50s outfit, but that's what it was in 1952. It's like that was contemporary when they made the shorts. But yeah, back to my Simpsons point, I could just easily see like the Simpsons writing team when Simpsons was like arguably like good.
Just arguably like, a show I could stand to look
at. Yeah, yeah. Would just like, and they have made fun of like stuff before like that. But it was very much like sticking up your nose at this kind of thing. Not realizing it's like, no, this is a really, really good, like, little short. That says a lot for 8 minutes.
Now we can definitely loop back to things, but shall we get into the post?
Yeah.
So reception of the film right out of the gate was relatively tepid.
Mm-hmm.
And bookings, even in Canada, basically they say the population was not used to experimental film. Yeah. So this was not a popular film to shop around.
No, no.
Pressure, and in the attempt to get distribution, pressure was made on McLaren to cut The Murder of the Families out.
Yes.
It was referred to as too gruesome, though McLaren agreed, since it still worked when removed. He looked at it and the sound would still make sense and everything. He did feel that the removal of the innocent victims lessened the impact.
Yeah.
That their war is not just affecting each other, but the people around them, which I can definitely see the point.
Yeah, no, 100%.
So that was taken out of most of the shopping around. It wasn't reinstated until 1968.
Yeah.
Specifically, one book said specifically during the Vietnam War.
Which would make
National Film Board. And that's to explain, like 1952, like a lot of NFB stuff has legs.
Yeah.
And is really influential for a long time.
Yeah.
And serves a purpose for a long time. There's not really... I mean, there's so much NFB output, but like, there's stuff like this, which is very evergreen.
Yeah.
You know, apparently they had to go back to some like really early prints.
Yeah.
Or outtakes and stuff like that to replace those scenes because it was basically on the cutting room floor.
Yeah.
And apparently you could really tell for years, but what we see, you can't tell.
No, no, not at all.
Because it's been restored.
It's really seamless. Yeah, and stuff like that.
But the distributor managed to book it at the Trans-Lux Theater in New York City, where it ran for several weeks, therefore qualifying it for the Academy Awards.
Yeah.
Which it was nominated. And it won the Oscar. Did you see what it won the Oscar for?
It was best short documentary, right? Or
best documentary short.
Yeah.
At the 25th Academy Awards. It was also that year nominated for live action short subject.
Yeah.
But it won for the documentary.
Yeah.
Do you want to address that here, why it was nominated for best documentary? I almost could have. I did a deep dive.
Okay.
I could hardly find anything. It was cited in a couple of articles about the Oscars that it is one of the, not misfire of issuing an award, but like a weird instance of a film winning for a completely wrong category.
Yeah. It's, well, it's just, it's like,
there's nothing from the Academy stating on this.
Yeah.
When I had that book, Oscar Wars, that I took out from the library, but I had to return because I just did not have time to read it because I was doing too much research for this stuff.
Yeah.
I wish I still had the book to see if they make mention of it.
Yeah.
But a 1952, I think there's more about Jack Nicholson and shit like that. And they're going to want to talk about then Norma McLaren, but they might bring it up. I don't know.
Well, the Oscars, like they always nominate movies for weird, like, stuff.
I did a bit of research on it. This is a Hunter deep dive.
Hunter deep dive.
Sorry, Hallie, this is going to be a long episode. I will give you more money for the hosting fees.
Put it on a shirt, Hunter deep dive. And sorry, Hallie, as well.
Okay, so let's do a little bit of a look into the history of the best animated short.
Yep.
First one was issued, and this is my scratchy notes. I didn't type this up, so bear with me here. Just did not have the time. Was the 5th Academy Awards in 1932.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know who won it?
No, I can't think offhand.
Walt Disney.
Oh, I mean, of course it did, yeah.
Walt Disney won the first 8.
Yeah.
So between 1932 to 1939, it was Walt Disney.
Yeah.
Winning every year. It is important for these first films that we're going to bring up. It is a producer who accepts the award.
Yep. That's for best picture.
Whoever wins it, their pen might not have touched paper.
Yeah.
Or celluloid or whatever. Yep. At any point, they are the producer of the film.
Yep.
Just bringing that up because usually now it is the animators or whoever that accept the award. You still get some producers.
Yeah.
But they usually split it with it. Like I know Pixar will have whoever the head of Pixar is.
Yeah.
Or overseeing it like a Lasseter with the animator. I know that happened with Bao.
Yeah.
That went a few years ago, the Canadian animator.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so they went until 1939. Then that streak is broken by Fred Quimby.
Mm-hmm.
Who was the man behind the Tom and Jerry cartoons.
Yep.
So he worked for MGM. So far it's Disney and MGM.
Yeah.
Then for the next few years up until 1947, it is basically back and forth between those two winning.
Makes sense.
At which point, Edward Seltzer wins for a Warner Brothers cartoon.
Yep.
So it's then those three. And I'm just saying, like, this is nothing against the animators or anybody that worked on these. I know now we think of these as being Saturday morning cartoons.
Yeah.
But they were innovative, hardworking. It's just a very different view of what we think of the best animated short nowadays, right? Even though you still get Pixar, but Pixar is doing crazy stuff.
Yeah.
Right? And then, once in a while, a Stephen Bostow comes in. Specifically with Gerald McBoing-Boing in 1950.
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen that one?
No, I have not.
It's a relatively... It's a kid that every time he talks, he goes boing.
Okay.
But they're also responsible for Mr. Magoo. Mr. Magoo won... Cartoons won the best animated Oscar a couple of times.
You wouldn't think it, but Mr. Magoo...
And they're with Columbia.
Yeah.
So we still have big studios. So before we come back to what was going on with Neighbors, I just have to note, ironically, it's the 60s. It's 1959... wife and husband animation duo win for a animation called Moonbird.
Yeah.
Where their kids did the voices. It was a very at-home production. So that broke the mold. And then 1960 was a film named Monroe. Which is a Czech film.
Mm-hmm.
And very experimental. So it's cool that it's kind of like the 60s is when the molds, the hold of the studios of that award get broken.
Yeah.
And it starts becoming what we think of now more of an international experimental
mm-hmm.
thing. And again, nothing against the animators that worked on those studio films, but when we talked about McLaren, that one instance from Cartoon Capers where it's like, he proved that it could be more than anthropomorphic animals.
Yeah.
Doing a joke.
Yeah.
That's basically what the first, what? 31, 40... Yeah, basically the first 20 years
mm-hmm.
of that award was for those sort of cartoons.
Yeah.
In 1952, there was a National Film Board actual animated short nominated... which is called The Romance of Transportation in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
It is one of the more educational ones I'm referring to.
Yeah.
It's cute.
Yeah.
It's on the National Film Board site and YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
I did watch it for this. I had never seen it before.
Okay.
So 1952 is when Johann Mouse won for Best Animated Film. Again, that is Fred Quimby. That is a Tom and Jerry cartoon.
Yep.
I just think people didn't know what to think of Neighbors. And they're like, It's people. This is what cartoon is.
Yep.
It's like when people can't get past that there are comic books that don't have superheroes.
Yep.
Or have Charlie Brown or whatever in them.
Yeah.
I think that's what it was. And I think it broke people's brains that they didn't know how to categorize it.
Well, that's what happened with
them. So they're just like, they're filming real people, put it in documentary.
Yeah.
Anyways, I know that's a me tangent.
Yeah.
But I did end up doing a deep dive with multiple Wikipedia pages figuring out
it happened.
The history. So you tuned into this episode, you also got a brief history of the history of the best Oscar animated short.
Well,
you can say that some of these, you can say some of this stuff at your next Oscar party if you want.
Well, it happened 10 years ago recently, but the Lego Movie wasn't nominated for best animated picture just because like there is a live action element to it. Nothing close to what Norm did.
Yeah.
But that's what kind of people assume disqualified it, because it had just a brief moment of real actors.
And you also get that with motion capture performances.
Yeah.
Not being eligible.
Yeah, I mean, there is campaigns.
So again, maybe it's because it's early on.
Yeah.
And there's new technology being used. There's that blur.
Yeah.
It's amazing that it fucking won.
Yeah.
You know, we're talking about McCarthy, you know, witch trial USA era, and this fucking pre-hippie, but hippy-dippy film.
Yeah.
Comes up where, you know, somebody from Socialist Canada has to fucking get up on stand.
Yeah.
Because the producer had to accept the award.
Yep.
So do you want to get into... I've had my diatribe. Thank you for indulging me yet again.
Yeah.
But I was waiting for Colin. He was running late for something. So I decided to go nuts while I was waiting for him.
That's fair.
And do a lot of research on the history of the best animated short. Because I wanted to try to get to the bottom of what was going on. So I don't have a definitive answer, but that's my theory.
Yeah.
So when the award was handed out, McLaren was working on a development project in India. And at the time, he received a telegram. Told you telegrams would come back.
Yeah.
Informing him that he had won an Oscar. Famously responding, "Great news. Who's Oscar?" He later said that he was disappointed because he thought that Oscar was a great big Saint Bernard or dog or something.
That's... Oh my God.
And he was also critical of the NFB for wasting money to send the telegram.
Oh my gosh.
This is who we're talking about. Not only... And I believe that he didn't know what an Oscar was.
Yeah, I mean...
Because he spends his life in Montreal sitting in dark rooms making his animations. It wasn't
like they were, like, you know, televised.
But the fact that he criticized the NFB, does not give a shit about the award for winning an Oscar. He criticizes the NFB for wasting money sending him a telegram to notify him.
Yeah.
I think that's pretty fucking funny.
It's good, yeah. Who's Oscar? They're not a dog? What?
He's like, oh, I didn't win a dog?
Yeah.
After the Oscars, though, the film's popularity grew, winning many festival awards.
Mm-hmm.
Though never popular in Canada for screenings, it was a huge hit worldwide, especially in Europe, where it became the most successful NFB film of all time theatrically.
Wow.
Though when released to the non-theatrical market in Canada, being shown in schools and put out to television stations, it became the third most booked national film board film. So it did eventually get popularity, just not in those initial theatrical screenings. So that's kind of the history of Neighbours. I have a couple of things summing up McLaren himself, but that's kind of the after that. It was a little bit of a slow burn. It's funny, a lot of these awards that you see it winning at festivals, 58, 59, 61.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's not immediate, right? Because it's being submitted to different festivals.
Yeah.
The film world isn't as immediate as it is now. Things do get shopped around, but yeah, for a guy who won a bunch of awards, this film definitely got him a lot of awards and possibly the most attention of his entire career.
Yeah.
As an artist.
It's...
And then after this, he just continued to not care about awards and went into obscurity and made awesome films for the next 30 years of his career.
Like, you can tell he was... just not in it for like the celebrity status that was really growing
for like, I said, he thought of himself as much as a civil servant as he did as an artist.
Yeah, because Walt Disney, he was an animator, but he went on to be like the big person of Walt Disney, obviously.
Well, because he became a monster.
Yeah, he became a monster. Yeah, he became a...
Can you tell I like to shit on sacred cows? I'm taking pot shots at Disney. I'm taking pot shots at The Simpsons.
There's no Disney adults here. Yeah, it's just, he's just such an interesting person that I know it's like kind of dumb. I know biopics are like the big thing now for like special music biopics, but I would love like a Canadian filmmaker to do something about him, just like a documentary at least, or
a documentary. Yes, and there have been plenty of National Film Board documentaries made about him. I actually didn't watch a lot because I got so much from the books.
Yeah.
I was like, I didn't want to naked lunch myself again and break myself myself brain with too much information. Mm-hmm. So I was happy with what I got from my books. And I kind of felt like, because these books are so long out of print, I might get some little nuggets out of
it. Yeah.
And I to fall into the wayside. Because I agree with you. I agree, especially after doing research and the influence that the NFB had, better or worse, because there's a little bit of both you could say on Canadian culture. Like we said before, Grierson did say that he brought a respectability to the National Film Board that we never would have gotten.
Yeah.
And the Animation Film Board created an engagement from the public with the film board that we wouldn't have had. And that's because, again, almost any animator that learns animation in Canada, there's some sort of a family tree that ends up at Norman McLaren at the very beginning. Which is why when we decided to do these, I knew we had to do an episode on Norman McLaren eventually, because they're synonymous with each other. So Norman McLaren ended up working for the National Film Board between 1941 and 1983, making 70 films. His films have won over 200 awards, making him one of the most awarded filmmakers of all time.
Yeah.
The most prestigious of which are the one Oscar. For Neighbors, he won the Palme d'Or at Cannes, I believe, for Blankety Blank.
Okay.
Because there's a special one for short films.
Yeah.
So that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
Three BAFTAs and six awards at the Venice Film Festival.
Mm-hmm.
But again, much like this podcast on McLaren, it is scratching the surface of his accomplishments.
Scratching the film.
Over 200. It's funny that you brought up the Wikipedia page, because I am bringing it up here.
Yeah.
That much about Norman McLaren at the top, not a lot.
I know.
His filmography, which is bigger, and then the list of awards.
Yep.
Your scroll. Especially on your phone, you're just like.
I mean, my favorite thing about like of doing this podcast is like, I think Wikipedia is a great resource. I 100% believe
we brought this up before. It's the first pass.
Yeah.
And then you want to go past that, which but is why I have invested time and money into all of this shit around me.
But I just, to books. I just love, like, he's such a, like, there's so much information about him, like big history about him. And his Wikipedia article is just kind of like, yes, he was born in Scotland, and then he went to Russia and became more of a communist. And it's just like, come on, like, make the sandwich be beefier or something.
And especially in these days where we live in like such a cult of personality.
Yeah.
That, I know I bring up Tarantino a lot, but Tarantino is just as much his personality.
Yeah.
And his vibe and his background working in the video store. Christopher Nolan, especially with the fucking annoying Nolan bros.
Mm-hmm.
So much of him as an artist, him saying how he wants his films to be seen, things like that. Norman McLaren is one of the few artists where it's like, you want to get to know him? Watch the fucking work.
Yeah.
He was so self-effacing and didn't have an opinion about his life and was so meek. Watch the art. Yeah. It's almost like who he is the art.
It really is, yeah.
That everything of who he was put on the celluloid that he loved so much. He loved film.
Yeah.
Physically, Tarantino. I still can't get past that. Yeah, it's so
Tarantino won't shut up about like some horror movie, and then Nolan's like Nolan. But
I know these are the pot shots we always take, but somebody has to.
I don't like Tarantino. I will die on that hill.
And then ultimately, obviously, passing away at 1987 at the age of 72.
Mm-hmm.
He was retired for 4 years.
Wow.
Again, maybe you don't need the biopic. Just those facts.
Yeah.
You know. Just fucking solid.
Yeah.
He has had many honors over the years, including being named to the Order of Canada in 1968. But we did comment on his influence on animation earlier, which is huge. But outside of animation, many, many people have been influenced. Obviously, many artists. Doing research, I think the best example of that range that I came across was from George Lucas to Pablo Picasso, who said that he thought Neighbors was the best film ever made.
Wow.
Which is kind of cool.
That's cool, yeah.
And yeah, anything else you want to say? There are just two examples from the box set that I wanted to share.
No.
This was a good breakdown before editing where we just cracked 2 hours.
Yeah. I did not expect us to do 2 hours.
We covered a lot of ground, though.
We did,
I'm sorry. I did a lot of research on this, so I wanted to make sure that
got you.
So hopefully you learned something. Hopefully the audience learned something.
I learned some stuff I didn't know about. The NFP and Tom. So I was like,
And for a podcast about the National Film Board, it took us to almost episode 90, but we got to tackle the National Film Board at some point.
Like I said at the beginning episode, if like my public school days showed NFP stuff and Norman stuff, I'm not saying my life would have been different, but like I feel like I would have been more inspired to do different stuff with my arts if I like saw Norman Schwartz at a young age, yeah, kind of thing. Like I would have been like, what is this? And like, how can I make my own thing like this?
I'm 100% sincere when I say this. If one person stumbles across this episode,
yeah,
and gets into Norman McLaren's work,
yeah,
because of this, this podcast is serving its purpose.
Yeah, no, it is. Yeah. Yeah.
So this is from Norman McLaren, the Master's Edition. If your library, like mine, has this 7-DVD set,
mm-hmm,
you'd be very lucky, because I was. This is from one of the many introductions by Donald McWilliams. And these are just a couple of instances,
yeah,
of McLaren that I think is a nice way to kind of wrap, yeah, up. I met Norman McLaren in 1968 when taking a summer course at the National Film Board in Montreal. I knocked on his office door expecting a walking, begone, dull care. Instead, there was a very shy man. At the time, I was an elementary school teacher. The purpose of that first visit was to show him films made by my 11-year-old pupils. They were in the technique, pioneered by Norman McLaren and other great animator Len Lai, handmade cinema. No camera, when drew, painted, and etched directly onto and into the film stock. He asked for one of the films and put it on a set of rewinds and slowly began to wind it through. After a while, he stopped, smiled, and said he would like to see them projected in a theater.
Wow.
He did, and was pleased by what he saw.
Wow. Lovely.
And obviously, McLaren being a teacher himself, but that's kind of touching. And this gentleman, Donald McWilliams, actually did a few interviews with McLaren over the years. And hopefully you will like this as a wrap-up. Mm-hmm. I once asked McLaren how he would be remembered in 100 years.
Okay.
Well, if it's a history of cinema, that's a huge field. The big part of it is the feature film, then documentary films, and then you come down to the smaller films. Maybe the animated films.
Mm-hmm.
I might be closed as an animated filmmaker, or maybe there is a little subclass called the experimental filmmaker.
Yeah.
In which I would prefer to be classed and would like to see myself mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, 100 years from now, as an innovator of new techniques, some of which led to a few distinguished or interesting films, let's say on the ground as an innovator of new techniques, that's certain. I'm sure of that. But to the assessment of my films 100 years from now, tastes change so much. I know it's avoiding your question altogether, but possibly 100 years from now, not many of my films will exist.
Yeah. That's crazy.
I in love with Norman McLaren as a man.
He's
in here. And to be fair, I didn't go into this because I didn't want to. He had a darker side. He had, yeah, some personal issues throughout his life.
Yeah.
But I wanted to focus more on him as an artist,
mm-hmm,
and not draw attention to those. But it kind of made me wish I could stop by the NFB and just like knock on his door.
Yeah.
And just say, hey.
Yeah.
You know, I like what you do. Anyways, thank you very much, James.
No worries.
All right. North of Normal is a production of Eldritch Creative that can be found on Facebook at Eldritch Creative and Instagram at eldritch.creative. North of Normal can be found on Facebook at North of Normal Pod and Instagram at North of Normal Pod. Intro and outro music is by Dad vs. Son out of Hamilton, Ontario. That's it for now. Be seeing ya.